reading from Startide Rising by David Brin. This is part two, which is called Currents, chapter 14, Denny. Charles Dart pulled away from the polarization microscope and growled an oath. In a habit he had spent half his life trying to break, he absently laid his forearms over his head and tugged on his hairy ears. It was a simian contortion no one else aboard ship could easily duplicate. Had he noticed he was doing it, he would have quit instantly. Of a crew of 150, only 8 aboard the Streaker even had arms or external ears. One of these shared the dry lab with him. Commenting on Charles Dart's body behaviors did not occur to Denny Sudman. She had long ceased to notice such things as his loose, rolling gait, his shrieking chimpanzee laughter, or the fur that nearly covered his body. "What is it?" she asked. "Are you still having trouble with those core samples?" Charlie nodded absently, staring at the screen. "Yeah." His voice was low and scratchy. At his best, Charles Dart sounded like a man speaking with gravel in his throat. Sometimes, when he had something complicated to say, he unconsciously moved his hands in the sign language of his youth. "I can't make any sense out of these isotope concentrations," he growled. "And there are minerals in all the wrong places. Siderophiles without metals. Complex crystals at a depth where there shouldn't be such complexity. Captain Kradecki's silly restrictions are crippling my work. I wish he'd let me do some seismic scans and deep radar." He swiveled about in his seat to look at Denny earnestly, as if hoping she would concur. Denny's smile was broad under high cheekbones, her almond eyes narrowed in amusement. "Sure, Charlie, why not? Here we are, in a crippled ship, hidden under an ocean on a deadly world, with fleets from a dozen arrogant and powerful patron lines fighting over the right to capture us, and you want to start setting off explosions and casting gravity beams around. Wonderful idea. Say, I've got an even better one. Why don't we just take out a large sign and wave it at the sky, something that says, 'Yoo-hoo, beasties, come and eat us.' Hmm?" Charlie cast a sidelong look at her, one of his rare, unhinged, lopsided grins. "Oh, they wouldn't have to be big gravity scans, and I'd only need a few teeny tiny explosions for seismography. The Edies wouldn't notice those, you think?" Denny laughed. What Charlie wanted was to make the planet ring like a bell, so he could trace the patterns of seismic waves in the interior. "Teeny tiny explosions, indeed. More likely detonations in the kiloton range." Sometimes Charlie seemed so single-minded a planetologist that it bothered Denny. This time, however, he was obviously having some fun at his own expense. He laughed as well, letting out brief whoops that echoed off the stark white walls of the dry lab. He thumped the table beside him. Grinning, Denny filled a zip case with papers. "You know, Charlie, there are volcanoes going off all the time. A few degrees away from here, if you're lucky, one might start right near us." Charlie looked hopeful. "Gee, you think so?" "Sure. And if the Edies start bombing the planet to get at us, you'll have plenty of data from all those near misses. That is, if they don't bomb so hard as to make geophysical analyses of Kithroop moot. I envy you your potential silver lining. In the meantime, I intend to forget about it and my own frustrating research and go get some lunch. Coming?" "Nah, thanks, though. I brought my own. I think I'll stay and work for a while. Suit yourself. Still, you might try to see more of the ship, other than your quarters and this lab.
I talk to Metz and Brukita all the time on screen. I don't need to wander around gawking at this Rube Goldberg contraption that can't even fly anymore.
And besides, she prompted. Charlie grinned.
And besides, I hate getting wet. I still think you humans should have worked on dog second, after casting your spells on us pan types. Dolphins are all right. Some of my best friends are Finns, but they were a funny bunch to try to make into a space-traveling race.
He shook his head with an expression of sad wisdom. Obviously, he thought the whole uplift process on Earth would have been better handled had his people been in charge.
Well, they're superb space pilots, for one thing, Denny suggested.
Look at how hot a star jockey Kipiru is.
Yeah, and look at what a jerk-off that Finn can be when he's not piloting. Honestly, Denny, this trip has made me wonder if Finns are really ready for spaceflight. Have you seen how some of them have been acting since we got into trouble? All the pressure is making some of them unravel, especially some of Metz's big Stenos.
You're not being very charitable, Denny chided. Nobody ever expected this mission to be so stressful. I think most of the Fen are doing marvelously. Look at how Kredeki slipped us away from that trap at Morgren.
Charlie shook his head.
I don't know. I still wish there were more men and chimps aboard.
1 century. That's how much longer than dolphins. Chimps had been a recognized spacefaring species. Denny figured 1 million years from now they would still hold a patronizing attitude towards Finns.
"Well, if you're not coming, I'm off," Denny said.
She took her note case and touched the palm plate by the door.
"See you, Charlie."
The chimp called after her before the door hissed shut behind her.
"Oh, by the way, if you run into Takat or Sahat, have him call me, eh? I'm thinking these subduction anomalies may be paleotechnic. An archaeologist may be interested."
Denny let the door close without answering. If she didn't acknowledge Charlie's request, she could feign ignorance later. There was no way she would go out of her way to speak to Sahat, whatever the significance of Charlie's find. Avoiding that particular dolphin was already taking up too much of her time. The dry sections of the starship Streaker were extensive, though they served only 8 members of the crew. The 130 dolphins, down by 32 since they had left Earth, could only visit the dry wheel by riding a mechanical walker or spider. There were some rooms that should not be flooded with hyperoxygenated water, nor be left to the gravity fluctuations of the central shaft when the ship was in space. There were stores that had to be kept dry, and machine shops that performed hot processing under gravity, and there were the living quarters for men and chimp. Denny stopped at an intersection. She looked down the hallway where most of the humans had their cabins and thought about knocking on the door 2 cabins down. If Tom Orley were in, this could be the time to ask his advice about a problem that was growing daily more irksome, the way to handle Sahat's unusual attentions. There were few people better qualified to advise her on non-human behavior than Thomas Orley. His official title was Alien Technologies Consultant, but it was clear he was also out here as a psychologist to help Dr. Metz and Dr. Baskin evaluate the performance of an integrated dolphin crew. He knew cetaceans and might be able to tell her what Sahat wanted from her. Tom would know what to do. But her habitual indecision reasserted itself. There were plenty of reasons not to bother Tom right now, like the fact that he was spending every waking moment trying to find a way to save all of their lives. Of course, the same could be said of most of the crew,
but experience and reputation suggested that Orly just might be able to come up with a way to get Streaker and her crew away from Kithrup before the Eaties captured her. Denny sighed. Another reason to put it off was pure embarrassment. It wasn't easy for a young femme to ask personal advice of a Mel as worldly as Thomas Orly, particularly when the subject was how to cope with the advances of an amorous porpoise. However kind Tom would be, he would also be forced to laugh, or obviously bite back laughter. The situation, Denny admitted, would have to seem funny to anyone but the object of the seduction. Denny quickened her pace up the gently curved corridor toward the lift. "Why did I ever want to go into space anyway?" she asked herself. Sure, it was an opportunity to advance my career, and my personal life was in a shambles anyway on Earth. But now where am I? My analysis of Kithrupan biology is getting nowhere. There are thousands of bug-eyed monsters circling over the planet, slathering to come down and get me, and a horny dolphins harassing me with suggestions that would make Catherine the Great blush. It wasn't fair, of course. But when had life ever been fair? Streaker had been built from a modified Snark Hunter-class exploration vessel. Few Snarks were still in service, as Terrans became more comfortable with the refined technologies of the library. They learned to combine the old and new, ancient galactic designs and indigenous Terran technologies. This process had been in a particularly awkward phase when the Snarks were built. The ship was a bulb-ended cylinder with jutting crane-like reality flanges in five bands of five along her hull. In space, the flanges anchored her to a protecting sphere of stasis. Now they served as landing legs as the wounded Streaker lay on her side in a muddy canyon, 80 meters below the surface of an alien sea. Between the third and fourth rings of flanges, the hull bulged outward slightly for the dry wheel. In free space, the wheel rotated, providing a primitive form of artificial gravity. Humans and their clients had learned how to generate gravity fields, but almost every Earthship still possessed a centrifugal wheel. Some saw it as a trademark, advertising what some friendly species had recommended. Terrans keep quiet, that the three races of Sol were different from any others in space, the orphans of Earth. Streaker's wheel held room for up to 40 humans, though right now there were only 7 and 1 chimpanzee. It also held recreation facilities for the dolphin crew, pools for leaping and splashing, and sexual play during off-duty hours. But on a planet's surface, the wheel could not turn. Most of its rooms were tilted and inaccessible, and the great central bay of the ship was filled with water. Denny rode a lift up one of the spokes connecting the dry wheel to the ship's rigid spine. The spine supported Streaker's open interior. Denny stepped from the elevator into a hexagonal hallway with doors and access panels at all angles, until she reached the main bay lock, 50 meters forward of the wheel spokes. In weightlessness, she would have glided rather than walked down the long passage. Gravity made the corridor eerily unfamiliar. In the bay lock, a wall of transparent cabinets held spacesuits and diving gear. Denny chose a bikini from her locker and a face mask and flippers. Under normal circumstances, she would have donned coveralls, a small jet belt, and possibly a pair of broad arm wings. She could have leapt into the central bay and flown the humid air to any place she wanted, providing she was careful of the rotating spokes of the dry wheel. Now, of course, the spokes were still, and the central bay contained something more humid than air. She quickly stripped and stepped into the swimsuit. Then she stopped in front of a mirror and tugged at the strings until the bikini was comfortable. Denny knew she was attractively built. At least the Mels, she knew, had told her so often enough. Still, slightly broad shoulders gave her an excuse for the self-reproach she always seemed to be looking for. She tested the mirror with a smile. The image was instantly transformed. Strong white teeth brilliantly balanced her dark brown eyes. She let it lapse. Dimples made her look younger, an effect to be avoided at all cost. She sighed and carefully pushed her jet-black hair into a rubber diving cap. Well, let's get this over with. She checked the seals on her note case and entered the lock. When she closed the inner hatch, fizzing saline water began flooding into the chamber from vents around the floor. Denny avoided looking down. She fumbled with her bateau breather mask, making it snug over her face. The transparent membrane felt tough, but it passed air in and out freely as she took rapid, deep breaths. Numerous flexible plates around its rim would help pull enough air from supercharged oxywater. At the corners of her vision, the mask was equipped with small sonar displays, which were supposed to help make up for a human's substantial deafness underwater. Warm, bubbling wetness climbed her legs. Denny readjusted her face mask several times. Her elbow pressed the note case close against her side. When the fluid had almost reached her shoulders, she immersed her head and breathed hard with her eyes closed. The mask worked. Of course, it always did. It felt like inhaling in a thick ocean mist, but there was enough air. A bit sheepish over her fearful little ritual, she stood up straight and waited for the water to rise over her head. At last, the door opened, and Denny swam out into a large chamber where spiders, walkers, and other dolphin gear lay neatly folded in recesses. Tucked into orderly shelves were racks of the small water jetpacks that the dolphins used to move about in the ship in weightlessness. The jets made amazing acrobatics possible in freefall, but on a planet with most of the ship flooded, they were useless. Usually one or two Fen were in this outer dressing room, wriggling into or out of equipment. Puzzled by the emptiness, Denny swam to the opening at the far end of the chamber and looked out into the central bay. The great cylinder was only 20 meters across. The vista wasn't as impressive as the view from the hub of one of the space cities of Sol's asteroid belts. Still, whenever she entered the central bay, her first impression was one of vast and busy space. Long radial shafts stretched out from spine to cylinder wall, holding the ship rigid and carrying power to the stasis flanges. Between these columns were dolphin work areas, arrayed on supports of resilient mesh. Dolphins, even the Tursiops amicus, didn't like being cooped up any more than they had to be. In space, the crew worked in the weightless openness of the central bay, jetting about in humid air. But Kredeki had to land his damaged ship in an ocean. This meant he had also had to flood the ship in order to enable his workers to reach their instruments. The bay shimmered with a barely suppressed effervescence. Here and there, tiny streams of bubbles rose toward the curved ceiling. The waters of Kithroop were carefully filtered, solvents added, and oxygen forced in to make oxywater. Neo-dolphins had been gene-crafted to be able to breathe it, though they didn't enjoy it much. Denny looked around, puzzled. Where was everyone? Motion caught her eye. Above the 5-meter span of the central spine, 2 dolphins and 2 humans swam rapidly toward the ship's bow. "Hey!" she shouted. "Wait for me!" The face mask was supposed to focus and amplify the sound of her voice, but to Denny it sounded as if the water swallowed her words. The Fen stopped at once. In unison, they swooped about toward her. The two humans swam on for a few moments, then paused and looked about, moving their arms slowly. When they caught sight of Denny, one of them waved.
"Hurry up, honored biologist!"
A large charcoal-gray dolphin in heavy work harness swooped past Denny. The other one circled about impatiently. Denny swam as hard as she could.
"What's going on? Is the space battle over? Has someone found us?"
A stocky black man grinned as she approached. The other human, a tall, stately, blonde woman, impatiently turned to go as soon as Denny had caught up.
"Now wouldn't we have heard alarms, then, if there'd been E.T.'s coming?"
The black man kidded her as they swam above the spine. Why Emerson Denite, with his dark coloration, chose at times to affect a burr was a secret which Denny had yet to pry out of him. She was relieved to hear they weren't under attack, but if the Galactics weren't coming to get them yet, what was all the fuss?
The prospecting party!
The fate of the Lost Patrol had completely slipped her mind, so caught up had she been in her own problems.
Jillian, have they come back? Have Toshio and Hikahi returned?
The older woman swam with a reaching, long-limbed grace that Denny envied. Her low, alto voice somehow carried well through the water. Her expression was grim.
"Yes, Denny, they're back, but at least four of them are dead."
Denny gasped. She had to make an effort to keep up.
Dead? How? Who?
Jillian Baskin didn't slacken her pace. She answered over her shoulder, "We aren't sure how. When Brokita made it back, he mentioned Fitbit and Sasia and told the rescue party they'd probably find others beached or killed."
"Brokita?"
Emerson jogged her with his elbow.
"And where have you been? It was announced when he got in, hours ago.
Mr. Orley took Hannes and 20 crewmen to find Hikahi and the others."
I must have been asleep at the time,"
Denny contemplated slowly, taking apart a certain chimpanzee. "Why didn't Charlie tell me when I came in for work? It probably slipped his mind entirely. One of these days that chimp's monomania will cause somebody to strangle him." Dr. Baskin had already pulled ahead with the two dolphins. She was almost as fast a swimmer as Tom Orley, and none of the other five humans aboard could keep up with her when she hurried. Denny turned to Danite.
"Tell me about it."
Emerson quickly summarized the story Brokita had told, of a killer weed, of a burning, falling star cruiser, and of the savage waves that followed its crash, setting off the desperate cycle of rescue fever. Denny was stunned by the story, especially young Toshio's role. That didn't sound like Toshio Iwashika at all. He had been the one person aboard Streaker who seemed younger and lonelier than she. She liked Amity, of course, and hoped he hadn't lost his life trying to be a hero. Emerson then told her the most recent rumors about an island rescue during a midnight storm and aboriginal tool users. This time Denny stopped in mid-stroke.
"Abos? You're sure? Native pre-sentience?"
She tread water, staring at the black engineer. They now were only 10 meters from a great open hatch at the bow end of the central bay. Through it came a cacophony of high squeakings and chitterings. Emerson shrugged. The action shook a coating of bubbles from his shoulders and the rim plates of his face mask.
"Denny, why don't we go in and find out? So far, all we have is gossip. They must be through decontamination by now."
From ahead there came a sudden high-pitched whine of engines. Then three white power sleds sped from the outlock hatch, single file. They veered, one by one, around Denny and Danite before either of them could move, leaving fizzing trails of supercritical bubbles in their wakes. Strapped to the back of each, under a plastic shell, was an injured dolphin. Two of them had dreadful gashes in their flanks, crudely bandaged. Denny blinked in surprise when she saw that one of them was Hikahi, Streaker's third officer.
The ambulance sleds banked under the central spine and headed for an opening in the inner wall of the great cylinder. On the last sled, clutching a handrail, the dusky blonde who had accompanied them here allowed herself to be dragged along. With her free hand, she pressed a diagnostic monitor to the flank of one of the wounded dolphins. No wonder Jillian was in such a hurry. It was stupid of me to slow her down.
Oh, don't worry about it. Emerson held her arm. The injuries didn't look like the kind you'd need a human surgeon for. Makani and the auto docs can handle almost anything, you know.
Still, there may be biochemical damage, poisons. I might be of use.
She turned to go, but the engineer's hand held her. You'll be called if it's anything Makani or Femister Baskin can't handle, and I don't think you'll want to miss out on news that bears on your specialty.
Denny looked after the ambulances, then nodded. Emerson was right. If she was needed, an intercom call would reach her anywhere, and a sled would arrive to fetch her faster than she could swim. They swam toward the buzzing of excited cetaceans in the outlock bay and entered the forward chamber amid a swirl of swooping gray forms and a ferment of flying bubbles. The forward outlock at Streaker's bow was the ship's main link with the outside. The cylindrical wall was covered by storage cells, holding spiders, sleds, and other gear for crew who might leave the ship on errands. The bow had three great airlocks. Port and starboard, the spacious chamber was taken up by the skiff and the longboat. The nose of each small spaceship almost touched the iris that would let it outside into vacuum, air, or water as needed. The stern of the skiff stopped short of the rear bulkhead of the 20-meter outlock, but the aft end of the larger longboat disappeared into a sleeve that extended into the maze of rooms and passages in Streaker's thick cylindrical shell. Overhead, a third berthing port lay empty. The captain's gig had been lost to a strange accident weeks before, along with 10 crew members at the region Kraydeki had named the Shallow Cluster. Its loss, in the course of investigating the derelict fleet, was a topic seldom brought up in conversation. Denny gripped Denite's arm as another sled passed by, more slowly than the white ambulances of sickbay. Sealed green bags were tied to its back, a bottle-like narrowness at one end of each, and a flat flaring at the other revealed their contents. There's no smaller bag, Denny thought. Does that mean Toshio's alive, then? Then she saw, by the decontamination lock, a young, dry-suited human in a crowd of dolphins. "There's Toshio!" she cried.
A little surprised at the intensity of her relief, she forced herself to speak in a calm tone. "Is that Kipiru next to him?" she pointed.
Denite nodded. "Yeah, they seem all right. By my count, I guess that means hist, hitched a sky current. That's a rotten shame. We got along."
Emerson's affected burr was completely gone as he mourned the loss of a friend. He peered through the crowd. "Can you think of an official enough reason for us to shove in there? Most of the Fen would get out of our way out of habit, but Kraydeki's something else. He'll chew our asses off, patrons or no, if he thinks we're hanging around useless and getting in the way."
Denny had been thinking about just that. "Leave it to me."
She led him into the jostling crowd, touching flipper and fluke to pry a passage through the press. Most of the Fen moved to one side on catching a glimpse of the two humans. Denny looked about the squeaking, clicking mob. "Shouldn't Tom Orley be here?" she thought. "He and Hannes and Tisht were in on the rescue, weren't they? So why don't I see him anywhere? I've got to talk to him sometime soon."
Toshio looked like a very tired young man. Just out of decon, he slowly peeled off his dry suit as he spoke with Kraydeki. Soon he floated naked but for a face mask. Dabs of synthetic skin coated his hands and throat and face. Kipiru drifted nearby. The exhausted dolphin wore a breather, probably under physician's orders. Suddenly, the spectators blocking Denny's view began to spin about and dart away in all directions. Bands of idle gawkers, cease their vain eavesdropping, lest the nets of Icky find them for their lack of work and purpose. The sudden cetacean dispersal buffeted Denny and Emerson. In moments the crowd had thinned. "Do not make me repeat myself," Kredeki reiterated. His voice pursued the fleeing spacers. "All is done in here. Think clear thoughts and do your jobs." A dozen Fen remained near the captain and Toshio, outlock personnel and the captain's aides. Kredeki turned to Toshio. "Go on then, little shark biter. Finish your story." The boy blushed, nonplussed by the honorific. He forced his heavy eyelids open and tried to maintain a semblance of standard posture in the drifting current. "Ah, I think that's about it, sir. I've told you everything Mr. Orley and Tisht told me about their plans. If the Edie wreck looks usable, they'll send a sled back with a report. If not, they'll return with whatever they've salvaged as quickly as possible." Kredeki made slow circles with his lower jaw. "A hazardous gamble," he commented. "They'll not reach the hulk for a day at least. More days still will pass without contact." Bubbles rose from his blow mouth. "Very well, then. You shall rest, then join me for supper. I'm afraid your reward for saving Hikahi for us, and possibly all of our lives as well, shall be an interrogation, the likes of which you might not even receive from our enemies." Toshio smiled tiredly. "I understand, sir. I'll happily let you ring me of information, just so long as I can eat first and get dry for a while." "Done. Until then." The captain nodded and turned to go. Denny was about to shout to Kredeki when someone else called out first. "Captain, please, may I have a word?" The voice was musical. The speaker was a large male dolphin with the mottled gray coloration of one of the Stenos subbreeds. He wore a civilian harness, without the bulky racks or heavy manipulator arms carried by the regular crew. Denny felt a strong urge to hide behind Emerson Denite. She hadn't noticed Sahat in the crowd until he spoke. "Before you go, sir," the dolphin fluted. His tone of voice was quite casual. "I must ask you for permission to go to that island where Hikahi was stranded." With a tail flick, Kredeki arched over, bottom side up, to regard the speaker. He addressed the Finn skeptically. "Talker Two Races, this is not a fish brew bar, this island, where poetry can buy back an error. Why venture now courage you never before displayed?" Sahat lay still for a moment. In spite of her dislike of the civilian specialist, Denny felt sympathy rise within her. Sahat's behavior at the derelict fleet in refusing to go along with the doomed survey party had not been admirable. He had acted like a prima donna. But he had been proven right. The captain's gig and 10 fine crew members had been lost, along with Streaker's former second-in-command. All the sacrifice had gained them was a 3-meter-long tube of some strange metal, thoroughly pitted by ages of micrometeorite impacts. It had been recovered personally by Thomas Orley. Gillian Baskin had taken over the sealed relic, and to Denny's knowledge, nobody else had seen it since. It hardly seemed worth the loss they had suffered. "Captain," Sahat addressed Kredeki, "I believe that there is a matter that even Thomas Orley could not have had time to cover in detail. He has gone on to investigate the wrecked warship, but the island still does concern us." "No fair!" Denny had been ready to do this. It was to be an act of professionalism, of assertion, to speak out and demand, Honestly, Captain, Sahat went on, after our duty to escape this trap and to service the clan of Earth species, what is the most important responsibility that has fallen upon us? Kredaki looked torn. He obviously wanted to chew Sahat's dorsal fin for baiting him like this. Also, obviously, Sahat had hit him with a double harpoon, mentioning the word duty and lacing it into a riddle. The captain thrashed his tail, giving out a low series of broadband sonar clicks like a watch ticking. His eyes were recessed and dark. Denny couldn't wait for the captain to figure the puzzle or slap Sahat into a cell. "The Abos!" she shouted. Kredaki turned and regarded her. Denny blushed as she felt his field of analytic sound sweep over her. She knew the waves penetrated her very viscera, telling everything down to what she had had for breakfast. Kredaki frightened her. She felt very far from being patron to the powerful and involute mind behind that broad forehead. The captain suddenly whirled about and swam to Toshio. "You still have those artifacts that Thomas Orley selected, young hunter?" "Yes, sir, you will please lend them to biologist Sudman and race speaker Sahat before you retire. When you've rested, collect them again, along with a specialist's recommendations. I will examine them myself during supper." Toshio nodded. The captain flipped to face Denny. "Before I give permission, you must have a plan. You'll get little material assistance from me, and you will be recalled at any sign of danger. Can you accept these conditions?"
"Yes.
We'll need a monofilament cable to the ship for a computer link, and talk this over with Kipiru before he rests. He must help you come up with something militarily acceptable."
"Kipiru? But I thought..."
Denny looked at the younger dolphin and quickly bit back the tactlessness she had been about to utter. Silently wearing his breather, the pilot seemed unhappier than ever. "I have my reasons, Femme, sir. As a pilot, he is of little use while we are immobile. I can spare him from the work here to be your field liaison, if I agree to your plan." The captain's attention made Kipiru hunch slightly and look away. Toshio put a hand on Kipiru's sleek back. That, too, was a change. The two had never struck Denny as fast friends before. Kredaki's teeth shone in the bright lights of the bay. "Is there more comment?" Everyone was silent. Kredaki thrashed his tail, then whistled the phrase of command termination. He arched and sped away with rapid, powerful strokes. His aides followed in his wake. Kipiru watched until his captain passed out of sight. Then he addressed Denny and Sahat. "At your service, you will find me, in my quarters, floating, breathing, after seeing Toshio resting." Toshio smiled when Denny gave him a brief hug. Then he turned to swim away, arm over Kipiru's back, keeping to the fin's slow pace. Just then, one of the intra-hull lift tubes opened, and a blue and yellow shape bulleted out of the tube. A joyful racket filled the chamber as the ship's other midshipmen speared past Kipiru and the boy, then zoomed around them in ever-tightening circles, chattering excitedly. "Do you really think Toshio's going to get any sleep?" Emerson asked. "Not if Aki makes him tell the entire story before he has supper with the captain." Denny envied Aki and Toshio their fellowship, as constant and intense as any star. She watched the boy laughing as he fended off his friend until they disappeared into the tube. "Well, sister," Emerson Denite grinned at Denny, "it appears you have a science command. My congratulations." "Nothing's decided yet," she answered. "Besides, Kipiru will be in charge."
"Kipiru will have military command. That part confuses me a bit. I don't know where Kredaki's aiming assigning Kipiru that job after the way I hear he behaved out there. My guess is it's his way of getting the poor Dolly out of his hide.
Denny had to agree, though she thought it a bit cruel. She suddenly felt a smooth, flat touch on the inner part of her left thigh. She yelped and whirled around with her hand at her throat, then sighed when she saw that it was the neo-dolphin anthropologist, Sahat, who had slipped in his left pectoral fin to goose her. The Stenos gave her an uneven grin. His rough teeth shone brightly. Denny's heart pounded.
Shark breath! Doggerel rhymer! Go make love to an unwashed specimen bottle!
Her voice cracked. Sahat reared back, his eyes momentarily white-rimmed in surprise. Apparently he hadn't expected Denny to be so high-strung.
"Oh, Denny," Sahat sighed. "I was just trying to thank you for interceding with Kredaki. Obviously your charms are more persuasive to him than any arguments I might raise. Sorry if I startled you."
Denny sniffed at Sahat's double-edged apology. Still, her reaction might have been overdrawn. Her pulse slowly settled.
"Oh, never mind. Just don't you sneak up on me like that."
Without even turning around, she could feel Emerson Denite grinning behind his hand.
"Males," she thought. "Do they ever grow up?"
Denny? Sahat's voice crooned like a string trio. "There is one small matter we have to discuss if we are going to be going on this expedition to the island together. Will you be churlish and let Kredaki choose the science commander on the basis of prejudice? Or will you give me a chance? Maybe we can wrestle for it?"
Denite started coughing. He turned the other way and cleared his throat.
Denny blushed. "We'll let the captain decide what's best. Besides, I'm not sure both of us should go. Charlie told me his analysis of the planetary crust samples may be of interest to you. There are traces of paleotechnology in recent layers. You ought to go see him right away."
Sahat's eyelids narrowed.
"That is interesting. I thought this planet was fallow far longer than would allow paleotech remnants."
But he dashed Denny's hopes. "Alas, digging for long toasted garbage of past Cthulhuan civilizations cannot be half as important as making contact with pre-sentience and establishing a proper patron claim for you humans. We Finns might have new client cousins before even neo-dogs are finished. Heaven help the poor creatures if the Tandu or Soro or similar ilk collect them.
Besides," he smoothed, "this is a chance for us to get to know each other better and exchange professional information, of course."
Emerson Denite had to cough again.
"I've left the repairs for too long already, kids," he said. His burr was back in force. "I think I'll be getting on back to me engines and let you two discuss your plans."
Denite's grin was barely suppressed. Denny swore eventual revenge.
"Emerson," she hissed.
"Yes, lass." He looked back at her innocently. She glared.
"Oh, I'll bet you haven't a drop of Celtic blood in your body."
The dark engineer smiled at her.
"Why, bairn, didn't you know all Scots are engineers, and all engineers are Scots?"
He waved and swam off before Denny could think of a reply.
"Trapped," she cursed, "by a cliché."
When Denite was out of earshot, Sahat sidled close to Denny.
"Shall we start planning our expedition?" His blow mouth was near her ear.
Denny started. Suddenly she noticed that everyone had gone. Denny's heart beat faster, and her face mask seemed not to be giving her enough air.
"Not here, we won't."
She spun away and began swimming.
"Let's go to the wardroom.
There are plotting boards and air domes. A man can breathe there. Sahat kept pace with her, uncomfortably close. Oh, Denny, he said, but he didn't press. Instead, he began to sing a low, atonal, hybrid melody in a complex and obscure dialect of Trinary. Against her will, Denny found herself drawn into the song. It was strange and eerily beautiful, and it took her several minutes to realize that it was also dirty as hell.